We're going to deal with, we're going to get today and today only, because we've got a lot of ground to cover in the last week or two in our class. Talk about, but we're going to look at the cross from a historical, perspective. Look at your beautiful outline I gave you. Marvelous thing. Calvary and the cross. Now, some of this material you may have covered in gospel and the life of Christ. But I think that they probably don't have time to cover much of this. So there's some repetition, you'll forgive me. But by the way, some repetition is built into our curriculum. It's designed for that. We kind of come across some of the same ground from different angles, and especially for the freshman sophomore classes. Cross, as we talked about yesterday, the Bible does not say very much about where the crucifixion was. It says it was outside the gates of the city. And I talked to you about the possibility of being able to revisit. I think that we ought not never. There's no grounds for saying that we know that we can locate the place where Jesus died. We cannot. And I give you my reasons. I think we cannot know it. That's not important because that's really neither here nor there. We come to the method of crucifixion, some of the historical considerations which embraced the crucifixion of Jesus. First of all, I would say that, which you probably already know, the crucifixion was a method of punishment which came from the East, from the Carthaginians, the Persians, the Median civilization, that is, not from Greece and Rome originally, but from Media. Very interesting that they are from the East. I think we can understand this if we remember, I think I covered this, albeit briefly, that in the East, man was viewed. Let me put it this way, I don't have time to go into it. Let me simply say this, that in the ancient world, in the East, a lower view of man, of the individual, was held than in the West. In the Greco-Roman world, the individual was seen to be of more value than in the East. Therefore, you would find man in the East, although the civilization was older, be more barbaric. By the way, anytime you have a low view of man, you always have cruelty. The lower your view of the individual, your philosophical world view of the individual, the higher that your level of toleration of cruelty. For instance, this is why communists, the enlightened social state of Russia, practices a penal system. Their method of treating anybody that they view as a criminal, sometimes just a dissident, political dissident. They treat them in a way that is. Reminiscent of the Middle Ages and worse. That's one of the reasons I find it very hard to stomach our government doing business with either Russia or Red China or any of the Asian communist nations, because their leaders are pure 100% barbarians. They have college degrees, but they're barbarians. They're not civilized. And since, for instance, the communists. They found a good way to do with political dissidents is to put them in a mental institution and perform a lobotomy upon them, destroy the major functions of their brain, make a vegetable out of them, and then solve that problem. They die conveniently. And if you know anything about the fact that every day several hundred prisoners die because they're put in the system. See, Russia's the prison system is designed to kill people. Because through the diet, or lack of diet, through the lack of heat, lack of medical care, and through hard labor, it's designed to destroy the physical health of the person, and they die in a certain period of time. And it was on the record that they died while in prison. It looks like an execution. And you see this in the communist nations. Very, very great cruelty. Why? Well, you see, they have a very low view of man. They're evolutionists, they're Darwinists. This man is simply to borrow the language of Oliver Wendell Holmes II, the great jurist of the American court, the Supreme Court, all over the home, said that man has no more natural rights than a rattlesnake. Man is one with the snakes and the doves. He's just an animal. I see a very low view of man, therefore we have a high degree of cruelty. Well, I kind of spent over too much time saying it, but simply to say that this idea, this custom of extreme cruelty, came from the East. When the Romans, it was a very effective method of deterrent. The ancients had no concept they never had a reformatory. You know, essentially, we had the difference between a prison and a reformatory. A penal institution was designed. The word penal means, came from the philosophy that a man is put in a prison so that he would repent. It's called the word penitence. Well, then there's the reformatory. That's what we have. That's our theory today. You put a man in prison, the idea of reforming him. And the thing that has gone by the board in our society is the idea of punishing him. In other words, the theory that, see, that the ancients worked on the theory that if you punish one man for a crime, it will deter another man from committing the same crime. Now, we don't believe that anymore. Because of the social experts have said this isn't true, therefore capital punishment has been ruled out in our society pretty much. Because they say it does not deter. They've asked all the criminals, and the criminals all said no, it would deter us, so they said it would deter anybody. Passed their laws accordingly. But anyway, without getting into the various philosophies of crime and punishment, let me say that the cross, it was based on the ancient system theory that you punish a man for a crime, you did it in such a way that it would deter anybody else from committing the same crime. And by the way, that's the justification for public hanging. You hang somebody in public. You used to do that in our country, by the way, in all of our states. Everybody was supposed to come and watch. Kids were supposed to be there. Watching hang, why? You would always remember that. And you would know that if I commit murder, that's what's going to happen to me with sort of deterrent. And the cross was particularly this because it was a very cruel, inhuman way, in a very visible way. Slow, a lot of people could come by and see it and learn from it, be deterred by it. Now the Romans borrowed it, but the Romans were more humane than those of the East in their cultural tradition. Therefore the Romans reserved crucifixion only for the very worst criminals. Of course you all know that a Roman citizen would never be crucified. Interesting. Peter was, according to tradition, Peter was crucified, but Paul wasn't. And one of the grounds for believing that tradition is that Peter was not a Roman citizen, and of course Paul was. Now, Romans would inflict this punishment only upon the very worst criminals who were not citizens. Because it was a very shameful way to die, the whole purpose was known as deterrent and humiliation. It was so bad that the Romans, I say, would never, a Roman citizen could not be crucified. The Jews never, they practiced capital punishment. What was the Jewish method of capital punishment?
Stoning.
Which was much more humane. It was quick. It was a deterrent. Everybody gathered around. They even participated in it. Or at least watched. It was to be a deterrent. You would see this, you would say, well, if I did the same thing, that can happen to me. However, it was not a particularly cruel death. That is, stoning was comparatively easy way to die. Not quite, say, like the firing squad, but not quite as, not quite as quick as a firing squad. In a few moments, a man was dead, or at least unconscious.
Yes. When they stone somebody, did they just throw them out in the middle and just throw them?
They didn't tie them up
or something?
I don't really know. Probably would. Not You mad about the show, Tom Seaver? Now, the Jews would never crucify anybody, with the exception that they would crucify a dead man. That is, to indicate that a curse had come upon him. For instance, in some instances, they would, if a man had been guilty of a particularly heinous crime, so that they felt that the curse of God was upon him, killing his parents, or some other really vile crime, they would often stone him to death and then crucify the body as a visible lesson to the community. But the man was already dead. And this was in the same sense that in times of war, for instance, there's a great shame if a body were not buried immediately, especially to the Jews, and if they wanted to indicate to the community or to anybody, to their enemies, that this man was cursed of God, was a particularly evil man, they would not bury the body. They would leave it hanging. We had instances of this in the Old Testament where bodies were left hanging until it just fell, it was rotted. And for instance, the great anxiety that David had to go get the body of Saul buried. Remember, the body of Saul had been left exposed, and David, well, the first thing David did was what? To see to that they were going to bury the body. So sometimes what I'm saying is the Jews, to indicate a man was cursed with God, they would crucify a dead body, or nail it up, or tie it up, in the same sense they would often leave a body hanging in times of war to indicate this was an extreme case. But they did not have a tradition of crucifying a live person. Yes.
Wasn't it the same way that the Romans crucified?
I don't know. Probably not. It was a matter of just hanging the body up to be, this is a great humiliation. It was an exception, yes.
You see many of the pictures depicted of the two thieves being tied to a cross with Christ being nailed. Was there a significant...
No, that comes from... y'all get the question? I see a picture where the thieves were tied. Sometimes bodies were tied to keep them from falling off. However, often they try to... This was something an artist's attempt to suggest that Jesus was... that he was different. They were tied. He was nailed. They often try to make the distinction between the three. And some of the grounds for that. Probably all crucified exactly the same way. But that's many of the reasons, I think. I've seen the same picture, but there's no historical grounds for that.
Now, there is an exception, and I'm going to read this because it was an important point. But Josephus tells about the time when don't worry about making too copious notes on this. Alexander Janaeus, this was during the Maccabean period, the intertestamental period, and Alexander Janaeus was fighting the Romans and the Ptolemies. It was a time of war, and without going into that, Alexander Janaeus was a Roman general, and he was very cruel. And a number of Jews had deserted him. They'd gone over to the other side. And so he said this: after the Jews which fought against Alexander, this is Alexander Janaeus, and being beaten were slain in great numbers in the several battles which they had, and when he had shut up the most powerful of them in the city of Bethome, he besieged them therein, and when he had taken the city, he got the men into his power, that is, these who had deserted him, and he brought them to Jerusalem, and did one of the most barbarous actions in the world for them. For as he was feasting with his concubines in the sight of all the city, he ordered about 800 of them to be crucified. And while they were living, he ordered the throats of their children and wives to be cut before their eyes. This was indeed by way of revenge for the injuries they had done to him, which punishment yet was of an inhuman nature, though we suppose that he had been ever so much distressed. And the point I want to make here is, this was an exception. This Jew, Alexander Janaeus, took a cruel man, did crucify 800 men whom he had betrayed him, or in his mind he knew as a traitor. And he had their wives and children's bones cut before their eyes. But Josephus, who was a late first century Jew, who had seen many crucifixions in his life, got this? He had seen all kinds. He may have seen Jesus crucified, for all we know. Not likely, it's possible. Crucifixions were common things, fairly common, by the Romans. Listen to what Josephus, this late first century Jew, says. Let me repeat this. He did one of the most barbarous actions in the world for them. And he crucified them. It was indicating that the idea for a Jew to do it was just unthinkable. This was the exception. And Josephus, he said the most barbarous thing in the world. Not because it was, you get the impression that if you just read that, wow, I've never seen anything like this.
But no, Josephus was very familiar with crucifixions. Well, the thing was so barbarous to him was that a Jew was doing it, to other Jews especially. So that's the exception that proves the rule. The Jews generally did not crucify. Now, I said all that so I could say this, that we see in Josephus, even on behalf of the worst enemies, that it was the crucifixion was simply not the Jews' thing. You got that? They viewed it as a great shame. Not capital punishment, but crucifixion. It's interesting, when the Jewish leaders wanted to get rid of Stephen, how did they kill him? They stoned him. And how were they going to kill Jesus? How were they going to kill a woman taken in adultery?
Stoned.
Yeah.
You know they had to be putting on Jesus to crucify.
Yeah, the point is that for them to, for the frenzied Jewish mob to yell what? Crucify him. Crucify him indicates the extremity of the situation. The hatred, the inflamed nature of this crowd. That is, it was out of character for a Jew to yell for a crucifixion. Often the Jews would gather into this. The Jews were crucified by Romans. So it indicates the extreme hatred when they yell, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" You understand what I'm saying? It makes it stand out in stark contrast. This was not the in other words, for most of these people, undoubtedly, this is the first and last time in their lives they were called for anybody to be crucified. Probably the first and the last time. Another, next thing I would talk about, we talk about the cross itself on which Jesus was crucified. There are basically four possibilities for the cross. The first, of course, have you talked about this in the life of Christ? First of all, there is simply the stake. Often they were crucified on a stake. And what religious cult today makes a great deal out of this? Jehovah's Witness. They say the cross is a pagan symbol, that Jesus was crucified on a stake. And they point that the Greek word, I'll write in English, S-T-A-U-R, staros, the Greek word, that's the English form of it, staros, they point out that this word means stake, and that's true, except that it has gained a specialized use by the first century, indicating this method of crucifixion. So by the first century, the word staros meant any combination or any form of a stake or a tree or a cross upon which a man was crucified. So the Jehovah's Witnesses make a business, their number one business behavior anyway. So they prove great, all kinds of great things. But there's a possibility he's crucified on a stake. The second possibility is the crucified, sometimes they were crucified like this, a T form cross. Now we know that Jesus was not crucified on this. Why? Yeah, there was a superscription written above his head. Now it's possible that if the head hung below the cross beams, that still could be there. Understand that? The head of the one crucified would be below that.
He'd have to go
strong to get his head down. Yeah. Well, it hang, but generally you can see that that's not the way. The next cross, actually is the Greek cross. And this is a possibility. Some said, well, it couldn't be this because it's still the superscription was above his head. However, it would still be possible. It could be put on that one of the crossovers and still be above his head. His head would be about here. Then there is the cross on which the cross members are of equal length, and this is also a Greek cross. This is simply another version of this. But the cross which has come down through the ages, of course, is a cross that looks something like this. And by the way, the earliest statement about this is by Justin Martyr. He says that this is the form that the cross was. Justin Martyr. And Justin Martyr is, you're looking at AD, he died in AD 165, the early first century. So that's a pretty early tradition. That is, now, let me sum up this point, it's not a very important point. That is, that the traditional shape of the cross was this, is this, of course. And this comes from Justin Martyr, early first century.
this is probably the shape of the cross. Although it is possible that it was shaped one of these other ways. Okay? This is probably the shape of the cross. Possible, it is a possibility. For instance, the Jehovah's Witness, they will argue for the, make a big thing out of it. I always say, man, I don't care. What difference does it make? No. That's not the point, is it? The shape of the cross has nothing to do with it.
And there also, it may have been one of these suggestions that they had a stake and that he carried the cross.
Yeah, that's right. The suggestion that this was a permanent fixture in the ground, and the one he carried was a cross member. That's possible. We just don't know.
I saw another form one time. I can't explain it. It was a cage form, and it had, you know, it was wood locked up like such. And there was a cage form that had stakes on that.
No, that's right.
Possible. Justin Martyr is probably right. He was a pretty girl. Justin Martyr would have talked to those who had seen it. Since Justin Martyr had, we know, talked to those who had seen the crucifixion, or could have seen the crucifixion. That is, he could have talked to people who could have seen the crucifixion very easily. Don't know if he did or not. That this is probably right. But I wouldn't sit up all night and argue about it. Well, he died in AD 165, or the first half of the second century.
Hey, did you
hold
the
Buddhists?
Don't they probably make a point of
it
because of the Roman
Catholic? Yes. They like to make a point of things. Now, the preliminary to the crucifixion, you probably studied this, that the scourging was done by a professional. And the scourging was, was so bad, literally disintegrated the body. The scourging was so bad that very often, very common for a person to die under the scourging. It was called the intermediate death. In other words, there were two deaths. There was the death of scourging and the death of crucifixion. That's why, if there was a skill involved in the scourging, you understand, you all understand the scourging was done with a weapon that had thongs with bits of steel or metal, steel or stone in the ends, so that when they strike the flesh, it would draw it back, and it was designed to embed itself in the body, and then tears, it was pulled out. It was designed to tear muscle. But it was a job for a professional, because it took an experienced Roman, experienced arm, to know when to stop. So the ideal scourging was that to stop just short of death. Just short of unconsciousness. That the man were scourged if they were unconscious, he'd probably go into a coma and die. And therefore, he would be in a comatose position. They did not want that. So the scourging was designed to bring a man up to the point of unconsciousness, but not, you understand, there's a skill involved knowing how to apply it. For instance, there are two elements in a skillful scourging. Number one, you were scourged in such a way that you would never destroy the vital organs. First, you cut into the pancreas or cut into the aorta, into a blood vessel that would, where a person, if severed, a person would bleed to death in a matter of minutes. Or into some of the vital organs, if you're up to the liver, for instance, or something, a person would die. So they were designed not to cut the vital organs or main arteries, and to stop short of unconsciousness. Of course, Jesus, this was in Jesus, and this is one of the reasons, of course, why he was unable to carry his cross all the way. By the way, this is one of the reasons why I believe that the cross was not Gordon's Calvary, because it was simply too far. But that's just the... Yes. Now, and of course, you've probably already been taught that the women of Jerusalem made a custom to try to alleviate some of the suffering. They would give an acrid mixture of wine and gall to them. As what? As an anesthetic, to deaden the senses somewhat. And this is what Jesus refused. Very significant, he refused that. He did not bypass any of the pain. Also, there's something in this incident, beginning, I won't take time to read it, but you ought to be familiar with it. This indicates that he was up off the ground some height. Why? What is there about that?
In the middle.
Yeah, it was on a weed, a hyssop, a weed, so it would be lifted up to his mouth. And but also, well, we know anyway, that the whole purpose of crucifixion
whole purpose of crucifixion was that it'd be a deterrent, therefore they would purposely raise them up high so as many people as possible could see.
Is there any significance to using the hyssop? Because in the Old Testament they used to use it to sprinkle the blood.
No. It's handy. It's like a long weave of cloth with briars in it. It's very handy. You can just, like a sponge or a rag, you jam it on the end of those thorns, and a strong stalk. It was used for all kinds of things. But it's a handy weave. Now, the as far as how Jesus was put on the cross, the traditional way of looking at Jesus put on the cross, the traditional view of this is that the nails were through the palms and through the feet crossed over in front, the outstretched hands. Probably not right. Although there are many, there was not one way of transfixing a man upon a cross. This is fairly recent, 1968, a group of Israeli archaeologists were moving ground in Jerusalem, eastern Jerusalem. They were preparing to build an apartment complex, which has since been put up. And in this, they came across an ossuary. You know what an ossuary is? In the ancients, they would family graves would be reused in this way. They would bury a body, and then some time later, usually a year or two later, sometimes 10 or 20, depending on the need, they would, when there was only the skeleton left, all the rest of the body had decomposed, they would, very reverently, they would take the bones and put them in these boxes, about like so, and label them and store them so they could use the loci, that is these burial chambers again for a later customer. So a lot of these have been found, ossuaries. Got that with a deposit where they would take the skeleton. Some of them are larger than others, and they would very reverently, you know, place the bones in these boxes and sort of rebury them. And they had found an ossuary of a man who had been crucified. As a matter of fact, the heel bones were still pierced by an iron nail. And he was probably crucified by the Romans during the Jewish revolt under Judas of Galilee AD 6 or 7. There were some Jewish revolts before the time of Christ, before his public ministry, and there were some after. At both times, Jews were crucified by the Romans. We know it was before the fall of Jerusalem because any Jews crucified after the fall of Jerusalem would not have been allowed the privilege of such a burial because they were dispersed and the city of Jews ran out. So it was one of the Jewish revolts before the final revolt in 1870. So sometime before 86, that is early in the revolt of 1866, or possibly one of the earlier revolts, but it was a Jewish revolutionary, young man. And very interesting, so this is the first indisputable archaeological evidence of a man being crucified. Very interesting, because we know now that the nails, or in this case at least, the nails were not put through the palms, but where? Through the wrist. Now, part of the reason that some artists have portrayed the tying them on the cross, because if you put a nail through a man's hand, it would tear out. These men were on these crosses very often 3 or 4 days. The longest on record is a man on the cross for 9 days, which means he hadn't been scourged. See, sometimes they would scourge them, and they would die soon. But they had not been scourged or otherwise harmed. They could live for food, could give them to drink, give them water or wine, sour wine. And they were there as long as 9 days. They were a very strong man. So the suggestion was that they put it through the hand, they would have to tie them on, and they would tear out. But they were not put through the palm of the hand, it was through the wrist. This man had been crucified through the wrist. Because of the layout of the skeleton, you can tell that the way he was crucified was not with the legs extended, you know, and crossed over in the front with the nail driven through the top of the foot, but the legs were drawn up under him, like in a crouch position. One lapped over the other, drawn up, and the nails put sideways to the side of the foot, to the ankle bone. So that he would not be straight on the cross. This man was crucified. He was turned like this, with this leg brought over this one, drawn up, and then the nail put sideways to the feet and the ankles. Which is probably the way Jesus was crucified, by the way. Now, You understand, don't you, that the purpose of the purpose of doing this was that the physiology of crucifixion was this: when a man was put out like that, or was strung out like that, that he could take a breath in, but to exhale he could not exhale in this position. He would suffocate because of his inability to exhale, so that they would have to push themselves up on their feet. You can imagine had to push themselves up in order to exhale. So every time they breathe, they would let themselves down. To exhale, they would have to push themselves up on those nails. And you can see why this is why the Jews, even Josephus, who wasn't exactly a pussycat, he was an old hardened soldier. He seemed to kill many, he seemed to kill. He said, "What a terrible thing, crucifixion." Which I think, now this is just, can't be sure, but I think that the traditional view of Jesus, maybe when he crucified extended, with the legs out straight, was probably not accurate, because that would destroy this. In other words, now maybe his legs were drawn up this way, you follow me? Maybe they weren't crossed over and turned sideways. His legs may have been drawn up under him this way, but the legs were bent, because the legs were not bent, then they could not push themselves up. The bending of the knee, that's how they did it. You understand what I'm saying? That's the thing, front ways, or lapping over sideways, in the case of this man, sideways, which makes it particularly excruciating. They had to push themselves up. And that's why, of course. Did you ever heard this before? Did y'all? You all said this before, haven't you?
No.
Wait, did you ever wonder what the connection was between the breaking of the legs? Why they, if they want to hasten the death, they want to get them off the cross? They broke the legs. You think a man were nailed to a cross and strung out, what difference does that make? Yeah, you see, the thing, to kill them, very simple thing to kill them. So to walk up with the blade of a spear and broke their legs, which means they suffocated, you see. As soon as their legs were broken, then they could not push themselves up to exhale. And they would suffocate and be dead within a few seconds, within a few minutes, maybe or two. So the purpose of the breaking of the legs was suffocation. You all understand that? Until I learned, and I never could figure out why we break the legs, saying that would, if you stick a man to crucify, that would seem completely useless. But this is what it was. And by the way, the legs of this skeleton have been broken. I believe that's true. Now, I'm not sure about that. I don't have all the details here, but I know that's true. Yes, no, that's right. That's right, I do have it. The legs are broken in the calf bones, below the knee. And this skeleton, this man at least was crucified with the nails through the wrists. You understand that? The legs crossed over, turned sideways, and nailed, drawn up, nailed them in sideways. The legs were broken below the knee. We did to make sure they were dead. So, indicates that he did not just hang there. That is, in order to stay alive, the instinct for survival, a man would have to be constantly moving against those nails. In a very interesting book by Jim Bishop called The Day Christ Died, you ever read it? It takes a very historically accurate view of this, or a description of this. Here's what he says. The penetrating nail supported the full weight of the body. The arms thus stretched into a V position produced two terrible results. The pain in the wrist became unbearable, and severe muscle cramps paralyzed the chest. Although it was possible to inhale, the victim found himself unable to exhale. Panic ensued. Struggling against strangulation, he would force himself higher and higher against the nail in his feet until his shoulders would be left on a level with his hands. For the moment, breathing was rapid and easy. Then, unable to bear the pain below, which cramped the legs and thighs, wrung moans from the strongest, he would let his torso sag lower and lower. And these projected a little at a time until he felt himself to be hanging by the wrist. And then the process would be repeated. Start to suffocate, panic, pull himself up, no longer, sag, and suffocate. Panic, pull himself up, breathe, muscles give way. So that's why I say if a man lived 9 days, that's possible. If a man, he may have been, sometimes to make him live longer, there was some kind of there was a seat projected out on the face of the cross, so they could rest some of their weight.
sometimes they would put a seat on it so they could sit on it and breathe, but then they would lean them forward so that the weight would be on the nails. And if they wanted a man to live a long time on the cross, then they would give him some support for his body, a small seat, so that he could breathe. This is probably not the case of Jesus, because in the beginning they knew it was quick business. And in fact, they broke the legs. See, we know that Jesus didn't have this because the man had the seat. The breaking of the legs would not necessarily mean death. He could hold himself on the seat, you know, by his arms. So in the case of a man living several days on the cross, he would not have to pull Jesus in to be nailed there, but he would not have his pulling up and down.
What was the actual death?
Mainly hemorrhaging. Well, let me read on. Severe local inflammation coupled with an insignificant bleeding of the jagged wound. They were scaled and scourging and not hitting a vital organ or blood vessel and stopping short of a coma. So that they knew just where to put these nails so that there would be a minimum bleeding. They didn't know what meant to bleed to death. Severe local inflammation coupled with an insignificant bleeding of the jagged wound, swell about the rough nails, and the torn and lacerated tendons and nerves caused excruciating agony. The arteries of the head and stomach were surcharged with blood, and a terrific throbbing headache ensued. The confused mind was filled with anxiety and dread foreboding. Traumatic fever soon set in and was aggravated by the exposure to the heat of the sun. It would cause you to chill and be hot. The strained position of the body and the insufferable thirst, which had a maddening influence. The victim of crucifixion literally died a thousand deaths. Tetanus not rarely supervened, and the rigors of attending convulsions would tear at the wounds and add to the burden of the pain. The sufferings were so frightful that even among the raging passions of war, pity was sometimes excited. The length of this agony was wholly determined by the condition of the victim, but death rarely ensued before 36 hours. The longest on record is 9 days, he points out. Death was sometimes they would either break the leg or they would deliver a terrific blow under the armpit to break ribs so they could not pull themselves up, which may have been the blow which Jesus received. That is a combination of the spear thrust and not so much to penetrate the heart. It's possible that when the spear was thrust into the heart of Jesus, that the man was not necessarily aiming for the heart, but it was a terrific blow under the armpit. And it was penetrated, possible, or even had been aiming for the heart. Don't know. Well, those are some of the things we know from history and archaeology about the cross. Any questions? Well, if you had time to read this thing about the shroud, very interesting. If this is what it could be, it is the real burial shroud of Jesus. What does it mean about the way Jesus was nailed? Does it indicate, what does it indicate, by the way? The wrist. And what about the feet, though? Indicates the front. The nail was driven through the front of the foot, not through the side, as in this case. So if this is the shroud of Jesus, it indicates his legs were drawn up frontwards, rather than sideways.
The back.
Well, it could be that the ones who gave the surgeon were under orders to be very sure they didn't kill him. This one we went on a cross. Others would make a difference. They died under. You know, they've been
told to
be very careful not to kill this. Yes.
Doesn't the Bible say
a bone
was broken, right? Yes. Well, they went through his ankles and through his wrist and ankle broken.
Well, they were separated.
That
would
have been broken.
No.
Well, they were separated.
No. Go between them. They would separate them. However, that prophecy, there was no major bone being broken. He did not die because of the legs being broken. the reason I think he didn't break his legs was this, not to fulfill that prophecy. somehow they didn't give me this Roman saying,
hey, what's up here in Psalms?
He died. He was already dead.
I think the reason they took the easier, I think they just gouged his heart, the spear, easy thrust, because for a man, it was hard work. You ever, any farmers, they're swinging an axe. You ever try to swing an axe and cut something high? Very hard to do. You may get an axe in your foot, too. It's very hard to swing, to get a good and heavy swing with an axe and cut, say, a branch that's up high. But you see, if Jesus was up, if his feet was about the level of their head, which is about what it would be, and they had to break the leg, they would have to have a strong staff to get a terrific swing. And it would be very hard.
It's fairly simple, just take a spear. He thinks he's dead anyway. Thrust in his heart, make sure he's dead. A lot easier. And I think that's why they didn't break his bones. It was probably dead anyway. Stick a spear in his heart. And you see, the purpose of breaking the legs was that the spinal death would also be agonizing. So they break the legs and they still live for a minute or two. And but the spear would not be the instant death. But if he was dead anyway, I'm sure why go to trouble. It could be that they had it would bring a horse in and so stand on the back of the horse. Or maybe two would hold one up, try to get a swing insufficient. A lot of power, strong arm, break the legs.
Yes. Would it have been possible for any people being crucified for him to out from the ground?
No, because through the wrist they would be able to hold.
Wouldn't be a piece of
hold them this way?
Yeah.
Probably not. I mean it's getting on the nail.
I've seen replicas supposedly of the nails, and they're like that long and yay big around, but they don't look like a nail to me.
Like a railroad spike?
Yeah. This skeleton has a spike. I think it's called spike. Spike. Wouldn't that take a big one to hold a man on a cross, by the way? Often these pictures of these huge railroad type spikes. I'm not a smell. Wouldn't be that big at all. This course is designed to lead us up to the course which some of you have taken for the first quarter, early Christian centuries. Now, we put the two together, freshman and sophomore together, as you have probably figured out by this time. and because we're trying to get back on a cycle as best we can, and we're happy with our. We're not getting all of our faculty here at the same time, you know the story. The point is, these classes haven't always followed the sequence, but it will for the freshmen. So, that is, the three courses which take us up, the three basic church history courses I teach, other than the specialized courses like calls or something like that, teach is the World of the New Testament, which leads us up to the end of the first century. The early Christian century, there's some overlapping there to begin. It takes up from then and goes on. And then the history of Protestantism, which we're going to take next quarter. Just the sophomore, by the way, I take the history of Protestantism. So the idea that when we get this all set up, you'll take the scope of the Old New Testament, early Christian centuries, history of Protestantism, which can be very convenient. But it's been impossible for us to do this the way we ultimately want. You have all the joys and the tribulations of being the first wants to do this, me kind of. So that's why. So today, some of you, some of the things I'm going to say today, I believe that you will sound familiar because this is the starting place. We're toward the end of this course, so we'll begin again to some of the things that will be the starting place for the early Christian centuries class. One of these is the Jerusalem church, because there is a transition between the Old New Testament and the early Christian centuries is roughly the time of the expansion of the church after it has become primarily Gentile. Now, some of this lecture will sound familiar to you. I thought I'd explain why it is the purpose now, because you have to cross paths somewhere. This material is one of the things that we do. Some of you can help me in this if I forget anything. We'll all be the same. But The church that we read about in the first part of the book of Acts is the church in Jerusalem. And your author, Ed Bruce, has some very fine things to say about it. I'm not going to repeat material. But I want to understand this in a historical context, that the church was Jewish for 10 years.
It's interesting that Jesus went not to the... Remember when the Syrophoenician woman came to Jesus for help? And he said, I am not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Jesus pretty much ignored Gentiles. His purpose in coming was not to preach to the whole world, not to preach to all the Jews. Interesting. Jesus confined himself geographically in a way that we simply do not understand if we do not realize that the purpose of Jesus' coming is not seen primarily in his teachings. We are not saved in the teachings of Jesus. The purpose of Jesus' coming was in the event of the redemptive acts of death and resurrection. Now, therefore, Jesus not only did not go to the Gentiles, he did address himself to Gentiles, but these were always the exception. And when Gentiles came to Jesus, but Jesus never went to the Gentiles. When they came, he did not turn them away, but he made it very clearly known this was an exception, as in the case of the Syrophoenician woman. Recall that he said, I'm going to deal with this, but you understand that this is not my regular program. He didn't even go to very many of the Jews, as we've tried to point out elsewhere in this course, that the Jews in Palestine, what we call Palestine, were a very small minority of the Jews. There were more Jews both east and west of Palestine than there were in Palestine. So he's going to remain the Jews. Let me simply say this, to sort of get this thing in balance, this may not be history, this may be theology, but this is not my Bible courses, but... Look at the teachings of Jesus. The teachings of Jesus, especially during the last half of the gospel narratives, so the last half, roughly the last half of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, deal with the final week of Jesus' life. You knew that already. And the conversations he's having there are, special, for the most part, specialized instructions to special men who had a special task, which include the working of miracles. Why? Why is that such an interesting? That Jesus comes to there, we read almost nothing about his youth. We don't read very much about his ministry. John says we just got a tiny fraction of his ministry. Didn't he? And the other thing Jesus did, which is not written, the Lord itself wouldn't contain the books if they were written. A little hyperbole there. But we get the point, don't we? So he didn't go to the Gentiles, he went to a very small section of the Jews. Only had one out of his whole time on earth. He only preached for 3 years. Only one of those years he preached to great crowds. He often avoided the crowds. Over half of the records that we have in his life deal with his instructions to his disciples. All of this indicates that his purpose in coming was his death on the cross, and it was the task of these disciples that are called the apostles, those whom they had taught, to spread the word of redemption to the world. Did not come to preach to the whole world, and did not do so. It's very interesting that one of the most common mistakes made in biblical interpretation is to take the special statements made to these special men for a special purpose and to generalize them. Whatever you ask, just ask, it'll be given to you. Boy, isn't that promise claimed by everybody? That's your achievement with miracles, please. It was written to me. I was spoken to me. Who would those miracles? Not to everybody. The promises of divine revelation being given, just claimed wholesale by almost everybody. Claim jumping is what I call it. Biblical, hermeneutical, exegetical claim jumping. And so, we see that the principle enunciated in the book of Romans is carried out in the ministry of Jesus. Which principle is this? To the Jew first. To the Jew first. Promise made to the national Israel. Jesus kept that promise, didn't he? Well, we see a parallel, I hope we see this, in the fact that Jesus spent his whole ministry. In other words, if I were planning Jesus coming, he would have preached for about 80 years and gone everywhere. But his public ministry was very short. And very limited. Not much is told about it.
And let's just talk about the rest of this lie. What we really are told about is his death and resurrection, right? Now, we see this principle carried through the early days of the church, the Jerusalem church. For 10 years, the church was confined pretty much to Jerusalem and Judea, reaching out some into the areas beyond that, but not very much. Now, if I had been, you know, if we'd been doing it, then they'd left Jerusalem at Pentecost and be able to go to the othermost part of the world. God never gets in a hurry. He's never late. The old saying goes, never hurry, never scurry. It's better to be late to the golden gate than to arrive in hell on time. God never gets in a hurry. And so we see the foundation being laid. The Jerusalem church, we find it is 10, when you get that, we all know this, when you get to Acts 10, the conversion of Cornelius, and the second and only other instance of the baptism of the Holy Spirit, it is upon Cornelius, and now the word is to all the world, the Gentiles, that God has no respect of persons. Now, but the church has been in existence for 10 years. This happened. Now, the number of things we need to say about the Jerusalem church. The Jerusalem church practiced a sharing. They were not communistic. That is, people shared what they wanted to share for the benefit of those who needed it. There was a famine. You read about this in the book of Acts and in the gospel there, and the epistle, I mean. So that the church was made up both of what we call Palestinian and Hellenistic Jews. What is the clearest example we see of the distinction between Palestinian and Hellenistic Jews?
Acts 6.
And the dispute that arose over the Hellenistic Jews said our widows are being ignored, they're being slighted in the benevolent program of the church. So they both came together in the church. It was the center of the apostolic ministry. When Stephen was stoned, the early church, the Christians were scattered abroad, but everyone preaching the gospel, except the apostles. These are during the days when the church was led not by the spoken word of the apostles, I'm sorry, not by the written word of the apostles, but by the spoken word of the apostles. Therefore, since the quote Bible, the New Testament, the church, was the word of the apostles in spoken form during these first 10 years, then it was necessary that the apostles maintain a center of administration, and they did. They went from Jerusalem down to Samaria to grant the Holy Spirit by the laying on their hands. Peter and John did when Philip went down to Samaria, right? But they stayed in Jerusalem. Interesting enough, Paul was accused of not being an apostle because he was not a part of the Jerusalem crowd. And when he defends himself in Galatians chapter 1, he assumed, everybody knows, that if he had been a second-hand apostle, he would have had to have worked out of Jerusalem. He was defending his apostleship as being directly from God, not simply second-hand from Jerusalem. And so the defense of his apostleship in the first chapter of Galatians, he says, it was after I was converted, it was 3.5 years before I even went to Jerusalem. When I got there, I talked to a couple of fellows, James and, you know, a couple, I can't remember who all I talked to. I had to leave town, the Jews got after me. So I didn't go up there right away for a long time. I saw almost nobody when I was there, and I had to leave town in a hurry. What's he saying? He's saying that my apostleship came directly from God, and it was not centered in, I did not come from Jerusalem. I did not go to Jerusalem and hear the apostles preach and then go out and present myself as one of them when I was not. The point I'm making here, of course, is that he understood, that everybody else understood, that the source of apostolic authority was the city of Jerusalem. Later on, we're going to talk about this, but this went on for some time. Then, of course, the jumping off places, we all know, for the Gentile evangelists, was up north, and it was the third city of the empire, Antioch. But not in this early period, not the world, not what we're concerned about. Now, they were not called Christians during this period. The disciples were called Christians first where?
Antioch,
up north. And so they were, what were they called during this period?
Disciples.
Those of the way.
Those of the way, right. But they were not called Christians. Now, during this period, I know I talked about this in the Christian Centers class, so this will be a review for somebody. But this is so very important to understand the book of Acts, historical background. That because it's the purpose of a history class to deal with cultural considerations, Hadn't Rodney realized that when the Jews became Christians, they did not become Gentiles?
I had a revival last December at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and one of the ladies, young ladies in the church, was raised in a Jewish home and became a Christian some years ago, and she'd been after her parents, and she'd been taking a typical zealot view, where her mother had succeeded in alienating her mother, and she agreed to come one night, and we sat and talked for a wee hours. But this woman, I knew what she was thinking. She had the concept that you're either a Jew or a Gentile. You're not a Jew, you're a Gentile. And I pointed out, she was sort of amazed and really got interested. And I pointed out, when you become a Christian, you don't become a Gentile, you become an Israelite. They thought when a Jew became a Christian, they became a Gentile. I said, no, when a Gentile becomes a Christian, they become a Jew. And when a Jew becomes a Christian, they become a part of true Israel. Right? And you see, I thought, there's no connection between being a Christian and being a Gentile. You see, these Jews did not become Gentiles, and you've got to understand this cultural background. Again, this is a review for those other Christian centuries, but they did not start eating pork chops right away. They didn't say, how do you have a Christian pass the bacon? Unclean foods were just discussing the day after the day of Pentecost as it were the day before. It's a proof of this in the book of Acts. Peter, 10 years later, was saying, not so, Lord, nothing common or unclean is ever entered by now. Now, also, they continued to practice, at least the Palestinian Jews did, they continued to practice circumcision. And their children, remember, ought not to. We know that they continued to worship in the temple on the hours of prayer. Paul was doing it. Even after he had grown his program of Gentile evangelism, wasn't come back to Jerusalem, he wrote the temple at the hours of prayer. Would the Jewish Christians go to the temple in prayer? Sure they would. It's a good place to pray. Would they participate in synagogue worship? Very likely they would. Most Jews, after they became Christians, continued to go to the synagogues until they were run out. The two-fold difference now. Number one, they probably would no longer participate in animal sacrifice. Although we don't really know how much they might have done it for old time's sake or whatever reason they had. Secondly, they kept the first day of the week. That's what the church gave them. Yes.
They didn't worship on the Sabbath.
Oh yes, they did. You see, the Sabbath was not a worship on the Sabbath really is not quite accurate. They observed the Sabbath. They go to the temple and worship only on special days. They didn't every Sunday get up and go to the Sabbath and get up and go to the temple. Obviously. And they would go to the synagogue, and the synagogue was not, strictly speaking, worship at all times. There was probably the community gathering, it was a time for open discussion, town hall meeting, a combination of things. All of it was the synagogue and preachers. Long after he becomes a Christian.
We were saying about the Jesus' predictions of the second coming and the abomination of desolation in 87 and Henderson's prayer. And Jesus said, pray that it doesn't take place on the Sabbath. Because these would be Christians that they would happen to. So they were still observing.
Yes, they probably observed it during the Sabbath. No question about it. The Sabbath observance continued. Whether they went to the synagogue or not, Sabbath observance consisted mainly of staying home with the family. A day of prayer and meditation. And as Christians, they would do that. Now, very important to understand that they did not become Gentiles. They kept the first day of the week, drove the Lord's Supper. They probably, for the most part at least, did not participate in animal sacrifice anymore. I'm sure they would not. Although we have very few specific sets, sort of assumed in early church history in the scripture, that's not specifically stated. The real problem came, as most of you know, when the Gentiles began to come into the church. The Jews had never, at least the leadership of the church, including Peter, by the way, had never really got straightened out in their minds whether this Jewishness was a matter of faith or a matter of opinion. That is, they had been participating in these Jewish, what we would call cultural expressions for so long as Christians. And in their minds, they had become associated with Christianity or service to God. That is, that these were still Jews. Especially the Palestinian Jews, who have no concept whatever of anybody who was a child of God eating ham and good Seventh-day Adventists. You have to even know. And so, this is why, in A.D. 53 or somewhere thereabouts, Paul is still writing to the Roman Christians, who are, Jewish Christians, telling them that it's okay for the Gentiles to eat what they want to. It's okay for the Jews not to eat what they don't want to. But you must not be a stumbling block for your brethren. Food is still very much an issue 20, 30 years after the church is established. Why? Because these people are very sensitive to this. Now, as we understand, and you see this, for instance, in the Great Jerusalem Conference, Acts chapter 15, the problem came when the Gentiles began to come into the church. And the Jews said, here were Gentiles, what were they told to do? They were told to repent and be baptized. And the Jews began to raise a storm. Well, what about circumcision? What about diet? What about Sabbath keeping? And you find many sections of the New Testament written this very problem, explaining, as was explained at the conference in Jerusalem. Notice Jerusalem is the center of doctrine, you see, still. It's period Acts 15, so we're more than 10 years into the history of the church. We go to Jerusalem, the apostles work it out so they understand that the Jews could keep these Jewish cultural aspects of their life, they keep on being Jewish to their heart's content, as long as they obey the gospel. But they could not make these Jewish cultural practices, habits, traditions binding upon the Gentiles. It make any sense to them. And it was a real problem to the Jerusalem church. It was disgusting to them. It took a great deal of grace to sit down next to somebody and he's eating hamburger. I'm sorry, he's eating pork chops. See. And if you go to the church fellowship supper, the agape feast, you sit down to this Gentile. He's eating ham hock. That'd be how it would be. How would you have to go to church fellowship supper? And you sit down next to this fellow on the other side of the tracks. He's your brother now. You gotta love him. And he's sitting there eating a nice, big, broiled rack. Would you have a problem with that? Well, yeah. I'll smile and bother at the same time. Now, I'm trying to put it like in a way we can understand. Do you see what I'm saying? These people had a real problem. It was more disgusting because with them it was not simply a disgusting item on the menu. It involved their soul. It has been trained that way. The Jews had to learn a very hard lesson. They had to learn that they could eat what they wanted to, pretty much. All the things they needed, they could eat what they wanted to. They could go to the Sabbath. They could circumcise their sons. And these seemed like so much a part of devotion to God that the Jews simply could not think of devotion to God apart from that. And yet they had, the Jewish Christians had learned a very hard lesson. These things, which made no sense to the Gentiles, they were not a part of the gospel. Therefore, these Gentiles did not have to come into the church, the synagogue. They did not have to become Jews to become Christians. It's like the Christians, when the Jews became Christians, they didn't become Gentiles. Well, the Gentiles, when they became Christian, they had to become Jews. And many Jews have refused to learn this lesson, and this is the source of what are called the Judaizers, against whom Paul writes the book of Galatians, who simply refused to accept this and said, no, you must obey the law of Moses. Whatever. In other words, they're saying the Adventism all over. There's a moral law, and you have to obey these parts of it, the important parts, the parts that we think are important, plus the gospel. And Paul says, no. You see, that's a part of the law. And we're not under law, we're under grace. You can't be saved by grace and by law. You've got to choose. If you're going to be saved by law, you're falling from grace. Therefore, one man views one day special. That's a special day, the Sabbath. Another man views every day the same. Each man be persuaded in his own heart. One man, you know, he can eat anything. Another man, he certain things he can't touch. Okay. After you've considered it, but you consider your weaker brother, and in many ways, you don't say to him, oh, you can't eat that. And on the other hand, if he's deeply offended, your weaker brother's a Jew. Well, maybe you ought to just pass up the pork chop that day. It doesn't make any difference. But have the weaker brother, it's a little grace and wisdom. And it took a bit of wisdom on the part of the Gentiles. Because they, to them, the Jew was a filthy piece of garbage. And to meet together in the church, you see, and this is not simply a dead ancient historical consideration. You see, the New Testament teaches very clearly. The New Testament teaches very clearly that the early church was multicultural. What does that mean? People of all cultures met together in one body. And they had, and Paul and the New Testament says, look, you have to learn to work it out. Now I say that because the Christian education now, the leading sacred cow now called church growth, teaches that you ought to have only monocultural churches because they grow the fastest. Called situation ethics. Of course they grow the fastest. Or it's easier if you have a church that has people the same economic level, the same color, speak the same language. No problem. Or it's easier they grow faster. But for the experts and poor in California to say, because they grow faster, that's why that's what God wants. They have to be very careful to avoid reading the book of Acts, for instance. The whole of the New Testament where it says you're one, you belong to each other, God has broken down the law of tradition. There's neither Jew nor Greek. Bond of free male or female. And so you're all under sin. God can put everybody under sin. He might put everybody under grace. You better learn how to get along together, or you're not going to see God. And that's the lesson that the church never has learned, by the way. The church never has learned that lesson. You see, any fool can get along. Doesn't make a Christian to get along with people that just like you, speak same language, same color. Economic level. I think Christians do that. In fact, people in the world do a whole lot better than church. You know, it's a myth of only church. You only love if you have the gift of the Holy Spirit. If a person kind of love on their own the Spirit enables you to love. Hogwash. I know people never even come close to the gospel do a lot better job of loving than a lot of church members I've seen. In fact, the number one lesson many church members never learn is love. If it's done under law. But anyway, and so this was a real, what I want us to see, we're in the theology, but we're brought there by historical cultural considerations that we're talking about. That these Jews were still Jews, the Gentiles were still Gentiles, and the great challenge both of them had to face was the challenge of living together, getting along together, being brothers in Christ, despite this broad cultural gap that separated them. Now, God simply is no respecter of persons. Peter said, I learned that hard way. That God has called clean, call thou not. Well, God is cleansed, call thou not clean. Now, any questions? Most Jewish Christians, or many Jewish Christians, when I say most, we don't really know, many Jewish Christians were on safe ground there, and many Gentile Christians simply could not bridge this gap. therefore, a gap grew between the church and the Jews. While the church for its first 10 years was Jewish, from then on, the ratio of Jews to Gentiles continued to diminish. One of the things that did this was, as Dr. Henderson mentioned in his lecture here on the Second Coming yesterday morning, the fact that following the instructions of Jesus in Matthew 24, when Jerusalem fell in AD 70, the Christians, obeying what Jesus told them to do, when you see the abomination of desolation approaching, but let him who's on the housetop go down the outside steps where they close the gates of the city. Let him who's in Judea leave the mountains. Go in the field, don't go back and get your coat. Call Emma and the kids and get to the high ground. Let's go. They set out the destruction of Jerusalem, and the Jews, the non-Christian Jews, never forgave the Christian Jews for that. They said, you betrayed your Jewishness. Now, one of the reasons, we don't know how much the Christian Jews understood this, but one of the reasons why the church was theologically justified in setting this out, there are many reasons, but one of them is that Jesus taught very clearly the destruction of Jerusalem was a judgment of God upon that city for destroying, for killing the Son, just as past destructions, especially that of Babylon, 586, 587, had been a judgment of God for destroying the prophet and rejecting the gospel. So that this was a national judgment. God used Rome, just like he used Babylon, to judge, in a national judgment, Israel, the Jews. The church certainly was not in line for that condemnation. But the point is, regardless of all the theological considerations, the historical fact is that the Jews never forgave the church for fleeing Jerusalem, sitting out the Jewish rebellion. So that, by the time we get into the early 2nd century, we find a great deal of animosity between the church and the Jews. We see this contrast, and we recall, as we're saying, that for the first 10 years, being a Christian was not antithetical at all to being a Jew. That's true, the Jewish leaders persecuted the church. They had instigated the martyrdom of James, where Herod sought to please the Jews. He did this kind of thing. He was going to do more. Part of the church was spread. But this was the temple crowd. The church had pretty much favor with the people. The common Jewish man. Common Jewish man may not have been a Christian, but he had a great deal of respect for the church. We recall, for instance, when the death of Ananias and Sapphira created a great deal of respect in the Jerusalem Jewish Judean community for the church. So that while the leaders hated the church, the common Jewish man did not entertain, generally speaking, a great deal of animosity toward the church during its early years. So we see this period when the church was spread or accepted by the Jewish community, not the leaders, not the temple crowd. The church was forced to face this cultural issue. The Gentiles became their brethren. And then, with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and because the Jewish nation as a whole we did reject the gospel, then you find animosity. For instance, one of the earliest writings by one of the early apostolic fathers, Justin Martyr, early first century, is his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, in which he's debating the Jew. And so this animosity continues to the early Christian centuries, and this Mr. Parsons is looking to see that by medieval Europe, the Christian viewed the Jew as a Christ killer. What I talk about anti-Semitism. Any questions? Yes.
The Christian Jews left.
They understood Matthew 24.
But the Jews that were not Christians.
They never forgave the Christians for running out. As they would think. See, there were thousands of Christians.
I think this is one of the reasons that it's a far more of a problem between
the Jewish community. No. The destruction of Jerusalem, the Jews, see, the Christians understood what Jesus was talking about. The 9 out of 10 Protestants that today think that he's talking about when he was in the house, I'm not going to say. They didn't think what he was talking about. Therefore, when the army approached, they left. And so, the Jewish community never forgave them for this. There were Jews, there were Christian Jews, leaving the non-Christian Jews to suffer the fate of Rome, not really any difference. But, and so this, on a broad cultural basis, this created widened seriously the gap between the Jewish community and the Christian community, created animosity. So by the early second century, you find the church against the Jews, and you find fewer and fewer Jews becoming Christians. But for the first 10 years, the whole church was primarily Jewish, very few Gentiles. There were exceptions. Yet, by the time you get to the second century, very few Jews being converted. Because there's this prejudice, there's this wall between the Jews. And the church was very much at fault, too. The church found itself classing all the Jews together and talking about the Jew in the New Day, with the same people as individuals.
What were some of the reasons for Rome to wipe out Jerusalem?
Well, because the Jewish revolt. It's AD 66. The Jews revolted under trying to throw out Roman rule.
What caused the revolt there?
Zealot leaders. Remember, Jesus said false messiahs would arise, saying, "Go in here, go there." He said, "Don't go after them." And the Jews did go after them. They claimed they would do what that was the zealots wanted Jesus to do, to lead them to in a political national revolt, like in Iran. And they believed that God was going to intervene. Everybody talked about this? This from Suetonius and Tacitus, this idea that the Messiah was going to give the Jewish world empire. They believed this. And it didn't work out. And the Romans made an example of it. Yes.
Where
can we
read about the
paper that actually left Jerusalem? I don't think which the apostolic father says that they, because of the prophecy, they. Let me quick, which story quick for the apostolic. I want to say Justin Martyr. I'm not sure about that. One of the apostolic fathers. I've got another note, but I'm trying to find that for you. I can't, for some reason, I can't remember which one said it. I remember
that. I'll take that for you. Any other questions? Yeah. After Jerusalem fell to Rome, and Josephus opened up the city, what did the Romans do to the Jews that were still left in the city?
They slaughtered them. They either killed or enslaved. Then they came in later, about a few years later, and thoroughly erratic, made it illegal for the Jew, for Jerusalem, for a Jew to live in Jerusalem. Then in 87, a few years later, as the revolt continued, they came in and just ran the Jews out. Made it illegal for a Jew to live in Jerusalem.
How did Josephus escape death from that?
Josephus was a strange character. He was there in Jerusalem, and he opened the city, but Rome was thinking he'd be merciful if they weren't. Then he was sent by the Romans to try to talk a band of rebels up in Galilee into serving him. But they went up, and for some reason, he ended up on their side. But they kidnapped him, whatever, so kind of abused. But he ended up defending them, fighting with them. They ended up doing a suicide pact where they drew straws and stuff like a little Masada there in the cave in Galilee. And they were going to draw straws. The last one alive would kill himself. And he would kill the next to the last one. And somehow, she was stuck in the ballot box, but he found the last one. Guess what? The Romans sent him to Jerusalem, to Rome. And he spent, really, his antiquities to Jews, his wars for a defense of Judaism to the Romans. Really. He was defending Judaism to the Romans. He was a strange character.
Because he was Jewish?
Yes.
So were there three reasons why the gap? Why there was a gap between the stuff you gave three? Or was it just there was a gap between the Jews and the Gentiles?
Well, no, the fall of Jerusalem had nothing to do with the gap between the Jews and the Gentiles. The fall of Jerusalem had to do with the gap between the Jewish Christians and the non-Jewish Christians. I'm sorry. The Jewish Christians and the non-Christian Jews.
It wasn't any Gentiles.
Yeah, the Jews of the church. Which is made of Jews and Gentiles.
Well, I thought you said this is what separated them. The Gentile Christians.
No.
Down
the Jews. So the Gentile Christians. There were very few Gentile Christians in Jerusalem. Those were all Jewish Christians.
So what caused the gap between the two?
That's what I talked about first. The Jews and the Gentiles. Got that? And they said they became one in the church. Right? So the Jewish Christians. Now there were the Jews who were not. Were non-Christians. Who didn't become Christians. So the culture divided these two. Got it? Politics divided these two. That is this thing about eating, the diet, and the Jewish cultural expressions caused a great problem between the Jews.